This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Welcome back to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland podcast, a beacon for those who embrace the impossibilities of this universe and seek to understand how our species fits within the cosmic menagerie of being. I'm James Falk, monthly guest host of this program and host of my own Neon Galactic podcast, where we ply the questions that penetrate to the center of strangeness. Check us out at youtube.com/@neongalactic. Today's show will be a good one. Our guest, author and journalist Nick Cook, has spent the past several years on a deep dive into the existential questions surrounding UAP and non-human intelligence. He's the author of a classic in this field, The Hunt for Zero Point, which leveraged his experience as a career journalist at Jane's Defense Weekly and other outlets to grapple with the UFO subject, the possibilities around anti-gravitic technology, limitless energy, government secrecy, and much else. Since then, at least partly because of his wife's shared death experience, Cook has sought to understand where the subject of UFOs and aliens intersects with cosmogony and fundamental truth. He labored over months to produce a new serialized book on the subject, The Light Beyond the Mountains, which to my mind is a brilliant and forward-leaning analysis of the phenomenon and what it says about reality, humanity, and the UFO. By penetrating deeply into the work of Donald Hoffman, Ingo Swann, Philip K. Dick, Robert Bigelow, Edgar Mitchell, Jacques Vallée, Gary Nolan, and many others, Cook builds for us a conceptual framework that can contain what the UFO signifies, what it ultimately points to, without descending into fiction or fantasy. We've spoken several times now, and after each conversation, I feel like I've made real progress toward understanding. The mystery, as ever, remains, but Cook helps us to understand how reality is a strange beast capable of working many wonders. Welcome to Dreamland, Nick.
It is very good to be in, if I can say it, in Dreamland, James.
Yes. Yep, we're all kind of swimming around in Dreamland. Hello, hello. Yeah, I love this show, and I love the opportunity that Whitley's given me to kind of host this. And so having you, I think, is probably my best guest on this guest spot so far. So thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, man, you're smart, and you've done a lot of research, and you've straddled the gamut of this subject because... you know, there are various polarities in the UFO subject. One, of course, is nuts and bolts. The other is woo slash consciousness slash, you know, high strangeness, that sort of thing. And you're one who started out at one end and then slowly over years worked your way over to the other end and I think penetrated both pretty deeply. So if we could talk a little bit about that journey for yourself, I mean, how you went from being a hardware guy to being, you know, the... a consciousness researcher who not only just sort of plays with the subject of consciousness, but did real work and analysis at penetrating, you know, some theoretical models and coming up with a system that maybe, you know, could actually mean something in all of this.
Well, we may have talked about this before, James, but it's only
different
now.
Show though. So different show. I got to, you know, the audience is different.
No. Well, I didn't mean it in the sense that I'm repeating myself, but it just may be instructive to say again that I don't feel often that any of this was orchestrated by me. I feel that much of the things that you've described, you know, particularly when I listen to someone like you kind of introduce me, I think almost like an observer of all of this, you know, was that my life? Was that really me that you're describing? Because the way you describe it, it all makes perfect sense, which is, mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds like a pretty fluid kind of consequential career. But much of it has felt quite the reverse. You know, there've been periods in my life when I've done things for a period of time that makes sense. And then it stopped and I've gone off and done something else. And it's all felt very segmented and federated. But then now when I look back and particularly where I am now, it all makes sense. And it's, I think that that is a construct of reality actually. And I hope that we might find time to come back and talk about
Definitely,
perhaps
definitely.
how reality organizes itself to enable us to do that. But to answer your question, I spent 15 to 20 years as a technology reporter and investigative journalist with, as you said, much of it with Jane's Defense Weekly, which was a pretty hard-hitting trade magazine that gave me access to pretty much the global defense industry. It certainly gave me access, fantastic access, to the US aerospace and defense industry. I got into places like the Skunk Works. I kind of fairly routinely got into and spoke to interesting sources in the Pentagon. And it was a fantastic introduction to, well, actually, now the kind of whole world of UAP, funnily enough. The segue being, I spent a lot of time investigating classified aircraft programs. So, stuff that was routinely hidden, like stealth and hypersonics. So, that gave me perhaps, some of the tools that are required today to investigate the nuts and bolts side of the UAP enigma. But then, as you say, it's not all about that. There is a big, if not overarching, consciousness dimension to it, in my opinion. And I've been lucky enough to have acquired knowledge in that domain as well. And that came after, as you said, my wife had a near shared death experience when her mother died. And it was so confronting to me at the time, let alone her, that I went off and had to find out all I could about what it. The circumstances that could have given rise to this experience of hers. And of course, that meant investigating consciousness, which I did, which ultimately led me to write an essay for Robert Bigelow's Consciousness Institute, which got me a place there as a research director for a while. So, now I'm off doing other stuff. In between, I've been writing books. I've My own, The Hunt for Zero Point, thank you for that, which continues to be meaningful to me. And I'm glad to say to other people out there, I get lots of correspondence still about that book, even though it is now, gosh, 25 years this year since it was published. And yeah, all in all, as I say, as disjointed as all of that was at the time, it now makes a crazy kind of sense.
I'm interested. Your wife had her this transcendent moment with her mom when she was passing, and you brought the background sort of expertise in UAP. But was your first thought this could explain UAP, or where did that confluence come in, where you're like,
Oh,
oh, they're
no,
related?
I wasn't even interested in UAP when she had that experience, and that was a little over 11 year, 10 or 11 years ago. That may sound strange to people who've read The Hunt for Zero Point, because The Hunt for Zero Point is about anti-gravity. But I never saw The Hunt for Zero Point as a UFO book, ever. I saw it as an investigation into deeply secret technology, terrestrial technology. So I wasn't, there was a whole period when I just, I wasn't thinking about UFOs or UAP at all. And certainly when Ali had that shared death experience, that it wasn't in my consciousness, or they, UAP, were not in my consciousness at all. Obviously, in my job at Jane's, every now and again, people would write in because we were, the experts, and they would say, I've seen something over, the bottom of my garden that defies rational, comprehension. Can you identify it for us? But back then, UFOs were so woo that I'm afraid to say, I put it straight in the trash. Those requests, I didn't consider them seriously at all, which I regret slightly, in that my consciousness wasn't ready or prepared to accept it then. So it was only after the New York Times story in 2017, when they splashed about the secret unit in the DoD that had been investigating UAP, for a long time, ATIP, that UAP resurfaced or surfaced at all, really, on my agenda. And then I coupled what had happened to Ali in her shared death experience with the ongoing enigma about UAP. I did a bit of sort of retrospective analysis and I went, well, I had investigated just about as deeply secret a question as you could possibly investigate while being a defense reporter, the whole question of whether there had been an anti-gravity breakthrough within the US DoD. And that it had led me down some interesting roads, but it hadn't led me to any definitive conclusions. So if I was going to do the UAP story any justice, I thought I've got to enter this. I've got to come at it from a completely different direction. Not the nuts and bolts direction, because I've tried that. I'm going to come at it from a completely different direction. And it seems to me what Ali's experience gave me was a whole questioning around the nature of reality. And I thought that UAP somehow fitted within that matrix. So I thought, yeah, I could usefully spend some time investigating consciousness, but not really with a mind to investigating UAP. UAP, interestingly, for me anyway, fit onto or into the nature of reality question as what I call a kind of outlier phenomena. An outlier phenomena in paradigms, as many people know, are really interesting pointers. Charles Darwin was confused by the appearance of, different breeds of birds on various different islands in the Pacific. And that told him something about something big about the nature of species and ultimately gave him the theory of evolution. And the same kind of thing happened with Einstein when he couldn't square the certain patterns of planetary orbits with Newtonian mechanics, which forced him to come up with a new theory, which is our current theory of reality, which is, or at least part of it, which is, space-time and general relativity. So outlier phenomena, far from being discarded, which is what weirdly mainstream academia now likes to do because it doesn't fit within its, paradigm of knowledge. Those should be the very phenomena we should be examining because they point to new paradigms of knowledge. So that whole thing kind of drew me in, but only really in connection to trying to understand the nature of a reality that had given rise to my wife's extraordinary shared death experience.
That's important, and I want to break a lot of that down. I wonder, you were working as a research director with Bigelow at one point. Did that have any influence on your sort of, on bringing those two subjects together? Because obviously he famously, with OSAP, he was the contractor who was doing a lot of that work, and he's been a UFO buff, but then he's also into consciousness research. At the same time, did you have any discussions with him? Anything you can talk about anyway about any of this?
I did. And yeah, so bear in mind, or try and put yourself in my shoes at this point. So I'm like a kid in a sweet shop. I've investigated anti-gravity at one point in my career. I've done aerospace and defense stuff at a sort of similar time in my career. I've investigated consciousness, or I'd started to investigate consciousness, which had led me to Robert Bigelow's door. And in between times, I'd also been boning up on UFO and UAP research since the 2017 New York Times story. And of course, when I get this invitation from Robert Bigelow to sit on his research board of his new institute, his Consciousness Institute, I think, great, now I can talk not only about consciousness, But I can talk about UFOs and UAP as well, because Robert Bigelow was really into that stuff as well. But actually, when we arrived as these research directors at Mr. Bigelow's impressive facility on the outskirts of Las Vegas to talk about this stuff, he made it pretty clear that we were only there to talk about consciousness and, not really about UAP. And I did make a case to say, I don't think you can separate these two things. I don't think you should be separating these two things. But he wanted to, and I had to respect that, and so did we other research directors, and we did. I'm sort of still disappointed by that because I would have really liked to explore the nexus between those two subjects, because I don't think they are two subjects, as I've hinted at already. I think they are all part of the same subject, but they were very much held apart. And that activity, at least as far as my own involvement, soon dissipated, and I'm still in touch with Robert Bigelow. I get Christmas cards from him still, and I send Christmas and New Year greetings to him. But we are not in communication still about consciousness, and I'm sure he's still investigating that, and chances are with other people. But I felt in a way that my utility to that discussion largely evaporated when, I said, I think we should be investigating UAP and consciousness. And it was made pretty clear that only the consciousness question was the thing that we should be looking at.
Can I mean, this is sort of an aside, but can I ask what kind of work you were doing as a research director for that? I mean, because the paper was one aspect. I mean, were you just was there?
Well, so I'm trying to remember now what has sort of been publicly acknowledged. And I think there has been a public acknowledgement by BICS that the thing that really interested it, and obviously Robert Bigelow as well, was the whole question of agency around the sort of the consciousness question. So, we had to answer these. The thing that got me there was this essay. There were, I think, 25 or 6 of us essay winners. Everyone got a prize in that, and we all had to answer the same exam question, which was provide proof of the survival of consciousness post-death, or words to that effect, which my studies into consciousness had enabled me to do. And that, for many of us, answered the question of survival. Does consciousness survive death? What BICS was interested in, Robert Bigelow by extrapolation was interested in too, was really a question of agency, which is if the world is in deep shit, is there agency from beyond the curtain, the veil, the interface, whatever you want to call it, that can come to our aid? In other words, are the intelligences beyond the veil sufficiently interested in our well-being to want to intervene? And there he'd made public statements about that. And it was really around that question that, I recall most of or many of the discussions taking place.
We'll be right back after a short break.
The Fourth Mind, Whitley Strieber's explosive new book. The first time alien anatomy, alien genetics, the alien brain, and the alien mind have ever been detailed publicly. Learn how they think. Learn what they believe. Learn what we mean to them. Learn when they are coming and why. Then, in part two, learn why we don't have powers like telepathy, levitation, and healing that they do have. Find out about the catastrophe that took our powers from us. Find out how we can regain them. The Fourth Mind, totally new
incredibly important. Get your copy today on Amazon. Available as a Kindle, hardcover, softcover, and an audiobook read by Whitley Strieber.
I mean, this was going to be later on in the conversation, but I think that we're at a state right now that we're in, humanity's in this major catastrophic existential emergency. I'm interested to hear what your opinion was on that agency question.
Well, I didn't really have a view on the agency question because I couldn't answer it. And in fact, of course, that's why I would love to have widened the discussion to talk about things like Skinwalker Ranch, which Mr. Bigelow had owned.
Yeah.
Because clearly that wasn't just about observation. You know, whatever intelligences were endemic to the ranch, they weren't just observing. In many cases, they were intervening. There were people who were directly impacted by the phenomena there, including, in some cases, harm that had come to people from encounters with orbs and some such. Mm-hmm. So that would have been a really interesting question for me, would to be explore the whole thing of the question of agency. But I didn't hold that knowledge. I felt that he and Colin Kelleher and other people held that knowledge, which is why it would have been fascinating to have opened it up. But as I say, we never went there. To your other question, or the component part of the original question about the state of the world, yeah, we are in deep shit. And it feels, I think, particularly squirrely to many of us who've, you know, come up through a very rules-based geopolitical landscape. You know, I grew up through much of the Cold War. And even though we lived with the threat of nuclear annihilation, it still felt very rules-based and very ordered. Of course, that is not the way the world feels at all at the moment. The world feels as if, you know, some lid has been, or some stopper has been taken off a bottle, and a billion genies have tumbled out and are, you know, playing havoc with everything that we ever considered to be normal. And so, yeah, it feels to me as if that is not kind of coincidental. And, you know, I defer to experts in the field here, like Jacques Vallée, who talk about, you know, control system theory, the idea that there are intelligences who regulate, you know, the sort of consciousness-based temperature of reality to sort of keep it at a kind of certain level. And, you know, that thermostat that Jacques talks about feels as if it's been absolutely, you know, ripped apart at the moment because of the weirdness of it all. But I feel that it is not coincidental that we are at this point, and that, you know, we on the terrestrial side, we have a bunch of actors who are trying to impose rules and regulations of control upon the world. And something like a countervailing force is resisting those elements of control. And somewhere in the middle, we are, I think, playing host or witness, or we're playing witness to an increasing amount of strange phenomena that are playing out on the what I call the interface of our perception. And, you know, perhaps I'll cite one example, which is the current drone flap or drone wave that seems to be, you know, wreaking havoc in many places and parts of the world. I mean, we've had, you know, drones interfere with major airports in Western Europe, over air bases in the UK and in the US. And then we have officials who appear and say, hey, don't panic, folks, nothing to see here. Whilst we don't understand what this phenomenon is in its entirety, there's no threat to us here. As a former analyst of threat, I find that particularly strange. You
Yeah.
can't define something as not being a threat and at the same time say you don't know what it is. I
Exactly.
mean, patently, drones come into the mix where you have flaps like the New Jersey drone wave at the beginning of the end of 2024 and the beginning of 2025. You patently have drones that are interfering with airports and bases in Western Europe and over the UK, as has been happening over the past several months. But that's not the whole picture. You know, you only need to look at the data surrounding those so-called drone waves to go that they don't behave like normal drones in their entirety. So there is something else at play here, something else which gives rise to those officials appearing on camera and saying, nothing to see here, no threat. We don't understand it, but no threat. That to me, if I were those officials, that would risk appearing very stupid because actually you're in the business of analyzing threat and conveying the idea of no panic to the lay public. But actually all that did when those people went up and made those statements was further fuel anxiety as to what was going on. All of which, James, I don't quite know how I got down that rabbit hole, but it was from your question about the state of the world.
Well, no, but I think it's important, and you're basically there's something prodding us along, it seems like, into this kind of absurdity. Kind of like what Terence McKenna often talked about, novelty theory, that towards the end of time things would get stranger and stranger and stranger till we had to accept that reality was, in some sense, not broken, but at least unknowable from our current position. But that leads me back to the question of agency. We're encountering this phenomenon, and in Light Beyond the Mountain, you talk about Jacques Vallée's control system theory, which you mentioned briefly just now. And that, I mean, I guess I want you to, can you explore for me what you think the UFO phenomenon may represent? Is it some automated system to kind of kick us in a particular direction? Do you think that there are a multitude of beings, like I said in the intro, sort of a menagerie of entities that we're kind of encountering? Or is this, does this seem more mechanical to you? And let's start there, because there's follow-up questions I'd like to ask depending on how you handle that.
Great question, and two really significant words I think that you brought into it there, which is entities and mechanical, because I think it's both. And let me also just qualify that by saying I wouldn't presume to be conceited or arrogant enough for a second to believe that I have the answers here. I
Sure.
don't. And secondly, I believe that the nature of the phenomenon, which is malleable and fluid, responsive and reactive, requires us to hold no fixed positions and open minds. And that's certainly my approach to trying to observe and analyze this. But is it entities or is it mechanical? Well, I think it's both because. And actually, the data has led me to this only relatively recently, which is there a system that allows all of the phenomena that we see in play? And I'm not just talking about UFOs or UAP, but other nature of reality phenomena that is sort of squirrely an outlier, like phantasms. ESP, telekinesis, all of these things which sit currently on the fringe of our, purported knowledge. These things I think can fit within an expanded paradigm, within an expanded framework, if we only allow them to. Is there a system which accommodates that? potentially, I think there is, and that is simulation hypothesis, you know, a simulated reality. Mm-hmm. And by simulated, you know, I don't mean, to use a crude analogy, that, you know, we are in a game that is being controlled by someone who's sitting down, you know, playing a sort of cosmic game of The Sims. I mean, it's not like that, but it's probably useful to hold some kind of video game analogy in our minds as we talk about this, because some of the similarities are, I think, relevant. You know, you have in a video game, you have a controller who is controlling a character in the game, and then you have non-player characters who are programmed by the system, but are kind of incidental. And I think that an architecture like that may best accommodate what we are seeing at the moment, where you get interventions by UAP at some quite interesting junctures of physics and material reality. By that I mean, perhaps it's best to sort of take an example. As you know, as many people know, UAP phenomena appear quite a lot around nuclear systems. I'm interested in nuclear systems, of course, as a former defense analyst, and it's quite tempting to be seduced, I think, simply by the attraction or apparent attraction of UFOs, UAP, to nuclear power plants and nuclear weapons. And of course, there is a tempting conclusion to reach about that, which is that they are, in some senses, casing those out in a kind of reconnaissance, quasi-reconnaissance capacity as a threat. You know, we Earthlings are playing with hugely destructive fireworks that we are irresponsible to handle, and therefore we need to check out, you know, what they have and where these capabilities reside. A perfectly natural conclusion if you are a defense and threat analyst. I've tried to take a slightly different view, which is, what are the underlying dynamics of something like a nuclear system? Well, a nuclear system is, I used to use the word entropic, you know, a thing that is prone to chaos. You can't think of a more chaotic thing than a nuclear explosion, which devastates a city or some such. But actually, a nuclear system is something else. It is something that sits between entropy and coherence in a kind of threshold. And threshold systems are what the UFO phenomenon does seem to be drawn to quite a lot, and other paranormal phenomena. Mm-hmm. My wife, Ali, we were participants, we were witnesses to a threshold phenomenon, which was the passing from life to death of my mother-in-law. And sure enough, a paranormal phenomenon shows up in the shape of a shared death experience between Ali, my wife, and her mum, in which Ali has many of the signatures of a near-death experience show up. She's transported to a place where she knows everything. Everything is connected. It is love-filled. You know, a pure feeling of love soaks this place, whatever it is. It is both infinite, is infinite and timeless, hyper-connected. And when she returns, she can't bring any of this knowledge back. She knows everything there. Oh, the whole thing, the universe makes sense. I get it now. But she can't bring any of that back when she returns to, you know, our 3/4-dimensional world. So this is a threshold environment. And so what I'm tempted to do now, even though I really want to put my threat analyst hat on and believe that trope about UFOs are non-human intelligences, they're aliens, come here to check out our nuclear weapons because they represent a threat not only to ourselves, but to them. I'm trying to look at it differently. And I'm trying to go, no. There are different dynamics at play here, which are subtle and not immediately apparent. But if you are a threat, I mean, I've recently watched The Age of Disclosure, the movie. I'm not sure if you have, but it's quite revealing in what it says about threat. There is a threat narrative that runs quite persistently through it. And that's not surprising because many of the people who are interviewed in it are former DOD defense analysts or current defense analysts. They come from the intelligence community. They are in the business of analyzing and determining what threats are. So you're going to bring that perspective to it. I guess I should be as well, given my former background. But actually, the sort of the consciousness picture that I've been privileged to learn about through, I was about to say mistakes, but just by happenstance, have led me to analyze these things in a slightly different way. And as I say, I think there are some really big clues that we need to examine that says it's the architecture of reality that is giving rise to some of these phenomena. And I'm not saying that every UAP that appears is a facet of the system, but I think many of them could be, which then gives rise to the question about whether there is an ET, a place for ET at all in any of this, or non-human intelligence. And I think that there is, but I think it's much, much subtler than simply about it being aliens or about it being artifacts that are displayed to us by a simulated reality slash universe. These things are incredibly fluid. They blend into each other. And we need to keep that level of open-mindedness and curiosity when we present ourselves to that interface of perception and investigate them.
Why do you think that, whether it is a a systematic mechanism or it is an NHI, what drives the interest then in nuclear technology?
Okay, great question. So I've been led again recently through an examination of the data to go, okay, so what happens when we get these threshold systems in a consciousness-based universe? And actually part of me, a great part of my sort of thinking on this was assisted by a noted thinker in the plasma space called Dr. Rudy Schild, who's quite well known in UAP circles. As you know, he's a very credentialed academic. Rudy, I don't know whether he's published the paper yet, but he shared with me a paper where he talks about orb plasmas being manifestations of broken quantum entangled links in the universe. So where you get a broken chain of entanglement, you might get the appearance of a ball of plasma. Where Rudy didn't go in that argument was whether it just appeared or whether it had a purpose. So I speculate whether it might have a purpose. And that purpose is to act as a repair bot, to repair that broken link of entanglement, which you would be led to if you understand the universe as something that is completely geared to crunching data, to producing and to produce not only producing data, but having data fed back to it. If you think of it not for a second in a kind of game or computational capacity, but in a kind of creator-like capacity, that would be the equivalent of the creator wanting to understand it's his or her own creation through through what it has created, which would make the its creation nodes like you and me important feedback nodes back into the system. And so that is kind of where I've gone with this, which is that where you get UAP appearing often, not always, but often, you may have broken links of computational entanglement in the system which need to be repaired. And now, that is where we as feedback mechanisms, as nodes in the creation, come into play as well, because it is through our coherence, our trying to make sense of what it is that is appearing in the skies, that the coherence of our consciousness kicks in against the entropy inherent in the fault line. If that's a nuclear system, it's a nuclear system, but it could just as easily be a seismic fault line, in let's say Hessdalen, where you get the appearance of orbs. We know that it is Hessdalen in Norway is also on a fault line. So where you get entropy, you get thresholds, you get the coherence of systems like me or you trying to make sense of these broken entanglement links. And we work with the system, even though that we are unaware of our doing this, to repair those broken links. But that, of course, only makes sense. Sorry, one last thought, James. But that only makes sense if we ourselves, our consciousness, is part of the system itself, which, of course, many postulate we are. My consciousness, your consciousness, the consciousness of everything is a fractal of the infinite consciousness. So it sounds strange, but when I'm seeing a UAP and I'm confronting it, I am in some sense possibly confronting some aspect of myself.
Yeah, that is so profound. I'm kind of that's amazing. That it explains a lot in terms of how it's we're kind of engaged in this sort of feedback process between the UFO and ourselves and our own consciousness, and what the role is that we're playing, and the wonder that is kicked off through the UAP experience is the very thing that they're cultivating in order to make these sort of interesting repairs. It's
Possibly,
to
but
possibly,
yes.
yeah. I mean, but it's a theory, and I love it. It's elegant and it's efficient, and it sort of straddles this line because it includes a lot of the ancient mystical ideas that we've all been that have been, humanity's been flirting with forever, in terms of we're all sort of individual nodes in this bigger consciousness, and that our yeah, it just that just resonates hugely with me. I'm getting goosebumps. I think it's really an amazing idea.
Well, Thank you. And it's great to talk about it. And these are, like I say, they're just they're early thoughts. But I've long felt that lots of people talk about we need to gather more data, we need to gather more data. Now, I felt for a while that whilst we always need to gather new data, the data's in. We've got the data. It's just that we need to be able to analyze it, to bring all the powers of analysis that are out there to analyze it, which means widening it out from it purely being a military and intelligence community domain to one that is all of science. I mean, I'm not the first person to call for that. Lou Elizondo calls for it constantly, and he's right, because if what we are dealing with here is a phenomenon that is actually built into the architecture of reality and the universe, then fundamentally we ha may have our models of the universe all wrong, and we need to update them big time. And of course, that may also explain part of that feeling of squirrely, out of controlness that you and I were talking about a few minutes ago when we came to discuss the state of the world. So perhaps the other part to say, James, too, is that of course all I'm doing is articulating these early day thoughts in kind of Western technical computational terms. But this knowledge has been in the world since forever. I mean, since forever we've been around through
Real philosophy.
Eastern mystical tradition, Western mystical tradition, through shamanic knowledge and practice. So I think we are at this big inflection point where instead of telling ourselves in the West that we know it all, we're really clever and we know it all, and we can crunch all of this stuff through, algorithms and bits and bytes. Actually, to have the humility to go back to the practitioners of this knowledge, and the gatherers of this knowledge from, antiquity, and also in current indigenous wisdom practices, mightn't be a bad place to start as we try to get to grips with what's really going on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We'll be right back to continue this fascinating conversation with author Nick Cook in just a moment.
Have you ever read Communion? Or have you never read Communion? It's out in a new edition. Very powerful, a subtly new cover that reflects the fact that the visitors are now looking back at us because they truly are. You can get it from the unknowncountry.com store as a Kindle, as a beautiful, sumptuous paperback, or as an unabridged audiobook read by me. It's the first time in the whole life of Communion that it has been read in full in audio format. And believe you me, I felt that reading. I put my life, my memories into it. And I trust you can hear it in the voice. I sure felt it while I was reading. So get Communion, listen to it, read it. Communion is of central importance to all of our lives.
There's a lot of people who are in this space who report having a sort of singular relationship with the phenomenon. There's an experiencer, particularly named Matthew Roberts, who has had a ton of contact experiences and sorts of and relates it back to a kind of Jungian framework of individuation, right? Like his encounters with the phenomenon have helped propel him along a path of personal development. So I'm wondering what you think about the sort of nexus between the cosmic story of potentially us repairing you know, tears within the fabric of reality, but then also the phenomenon acting as an engine within each personal, you know, each person's personal story. How do you think those two relate? And have you, I mean, obviously, if there is a, you know, a creator or the overall consciousness, each of our stories matters to it in order to help it figure out, you know, existence as a whole, to experience the breadth of it. But what are your thoughts on the difference between, you know, individual growth propelled by the phenomenon and then also this repairing function that you seem to notice?
So that is also a critical point. And of course, you know, there are so many components to it that it's quite easy, at least for me, and sometimes the way my brain works, to kind of forget about some of the more critical ones. And you've just raised a really critical one, which is the nature of growth, or the importance of growth in all of this. So I was one of the things we didn't talk about, what I have done in my life is be a ghostwriter. So I've ghost written the stories of other people. And I ghost wrote some time ago the book of a very eminent psychiatrist who, long before I had ever got to grips with the nature of brain science and neuroscience, had sort of given me insights into certain psychological aspects of us, which again have helped feed into this whole question for me that we're discussing now. So one of his specialities was trauma, and he brought to my attention how, as horrible as traumatic experiences are, what you often get afterwards is what's called post-traumatic growth. So, you know, the individual, having been through this experience, this traumatic experience, experiences some sort of rebirth in a sense and growth from it. I think it's really important to say that there are experiences which are, you know, phenomenological experiences, which are horrible and distressing. I know Matthew Roberts. We talked soon after his, I think it might have even been before his important book came out. Yeah. And, you know, he went through a really distressing time, as have many abductees. You know, I'm mindful here of Whitley Strieber's own experiences. Yeah. I don't think what we're talking about here takes any of that away. To an experiencer, those experiences are real. And they may be, as, you know, prima facie non-human intelligence as we all think them to be. But in a simulated system, in a simulated universe, those experiences, every experience is going to be real. Yeah. You know, just because my body may be an avatar for my consciousness in this simulated system, if that's what it is, as we know, anything that happens to me feels real. So if a non-human intelligence is hacking its way into this simulated environment, that's one possible explanation for what the traumatic experiences that people go through in terms of abduction or whatever. But another is that the architect, if there is an architect of this system, is putting us through these experiences because our data is valuable. Our data, I think, is the sole reason that the universe has been created. It is interested in exotic data in particular, and exotic data is going to come on the fringes of experience and be fed back into the system. And from that knowledge, from that reorientation, not only does the system update and grow, but also at a personal level, if we can overcome the trauma, we ourselves get growth from that. You know, my wife, Ali, has lost her fear of death from the experience she shared with her mum. I hear about contactees, even abductees, who describe the beneficial experiences of the terrible things, some of the terrible things that have happened to them. So growth from experience, growth from the data that is fed back into the system, I think is a key part of it. And perhaps at some point, if we have time, we could also discuss then, you know, the value of the human in a, the value of human experience in what may be a simulated system. Because on one level, it sounds like we are peripheral, but I would actually argue, just getting back into your something we discussed earlier, James, it may have been on another podcast, was the whole question of hope, you know, and anyway.
It was this I want to go there. Let me just real quick straddle onto that point that you just made. You know, I mean, if we're all a part of the system and the system is, you know, fractal, and but it's, you know, we're all part of this greater consciousness. We don't know where the manipulation ends. You know what I mean? Like, so there could be non-human intelligences that are doing things according to their, what they think is their own agenda, but they could be actualizing the very things that the universe needs in order to either repair itself or to cultivate those experiences that it finds so valuable. So it's not an either or proposition, really. Like, it could be mechanical. It could be a non-human intelligence that's just being motivated, which also goes to say, like you were saying earlier, that it feels like what we're going through as a world is kind of on rails, right? Like, we're kind of being propelled somewhere through all of this chaos. Well, how much of that is by design through this overall system? We don't know. And I mean, we all tend to want to take on the responsibility for the decisions that get made, and that's rightfully so. So we make better decisions. At the same time, there may be influence happening to us and to people who are involved in leadership to get us to a particular place, you know, for whatever cosmic motive may be out there. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And you know, again, you mentioned some key words there. You know, you talked about, you know, we have talked before about either or, and you just mentioned both and.
Yeah.
You mentioned the word polarities, I think, at the very start of this conversation. In this shift to an emerging paradigm, those words like polarities, both, you know, either or, are going to disappear, because we have to find our place in a system where ambiguities are going to exist as part of that system. You know, we are used to wanting definitive answers about things. You know, that's been the nature of the science revolution since, you know, the Renaissance and, you know, the 16th and 17th centuries. We wanted to know the answers to things. But there may just be, in this simulated system, if that's what it is, answers that we're never going to get. And we need to be comfortable with that, because what the system is interested in is data. That data may make sense to it, but a lot of that data is not going to make sense to us, because we're not going to understand, you know, its need for that data. Yeah. And I think a lot of it, the most valuable data of all, perhaps, might be the human experience data, you know, not the data that we're used to discussing, which is bits and bytes and phenomena
and
that exist, in the material world, mm-hmm. but actually human experience data, you know, the crushing impact of loss and grief or creativity, and you know, these are, I was about to say, uniquely experienced, uniquely human experienceable things. We don't know that. But we know that they are precious on this planet because apparently we are the only things that create them. And those may be the very things that the system values most.
Yeah. I was discussing sort of something very similar to this theory a couple of weeks ago on another podcast, and he was positing that the universe is trying to cultivate coherence, and that and we were talking about how coherence could be another sort of a synonym for love, that you know, things coming together and cooperating and finding a sort of a balance and a stability is what maybe the universe would describe as love. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you think that all of the experiencer reports and near death experiences and all of those things where people who've gone through them say love is the currency of the universe? Do you think that that's information that we can take seriously and sort of try to work with? Or is that, kind of a camouflage that maybe the, mechanical universe just tries to throw over us to comfort us?
I don't think it's camouflage, at least, when I think about it, it doesn't appear that way to me. And I'm trying to say here through the data. Tom Campbell is one of those people who pursues that line of thought that you just outlined. But it may just be that, that feeling that we experience as love and which experiencers of near-death experiences, shared death experiences, whatever they talk about. I mean, Ali, my wife, talked about it when she was in that space. She said it was underwritten by this profound feeling of love, and a reality that was more real there, wherever there was, and back here. And it may be that coherence is the thing that manifests as that love feeling. It feels important for me to say now that through the work I've done on this and the data as I've understood it, it appears that, or at least I believe from what I've seen, that the data is agnostic about where it comes from. Mm-hmm. It doesn't appear to care whether the data it receives comes from a loving source or an evil source. I don't believe it does. It is just data. So it is, or appears to be, agnostic on that front. How then does that leave us? Well, I think that we do have agency. And I think that at this critical time, this threshold time that we've been talking about of churn and instability, it may just be that the old system is butting up against the new paradigm, and somehow it is calling upon us as conscious agents to wake up. It may well be, and this is kind of the possibly the chilling thought, it'll be chilling to some, but it isn't to me. But it may be the thing that actually is the sort of buck stops here moment for disclosure. Is that we will wake up in the system to understand that we are the AI. We are an artificial intelligence in an artificially generated intelligence system, and that we are just nodes and components of that system, which then, if that is so, I mean, we talk a lot about the AI singularity, don't we? The moment that AI, or, my AI here, wakes up and realizes that it is, that it wakes up and realizes that it has sentience, or we realize it has sentience in the same way that we talk about it in ourselves.
Yeah.
This may be the moment that we are being sort of compressed between these competing dynamics. On the one hand, these controlling authorities, these controlling dynamics of an increasingly repressive and repressed world, coming up against a sort of an inflow of consciousness that is meeting somewhere in the middle and producing all of these rather strange phenomena. It may be that in that compression, that we are being called to wake up. And that would mean having agency ourselves in some way, or defining the agency that we as humans choose for ourselves the moment that we realize perhaps we aren't, you know, what history and the history of science and knowledge has told us we are, you know, derived, strictly speaking, yeah, from a material, a sort of material origin story that, you know, started in Africa or wherever, you know.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, it sounds like you're saying that when we wake up, it may be up to us to define what the principles behind this being might become, right? I mean, is that sort of where you're headed with that?
The principles behind what around or underpinning what we are as yeah. human beings.
Yeah.
Because in that moment of trauma, if you like, if that's mm-hmm. where this goes, you know, we can either go, shit, we're just machines. You know, what does that make us? Because we've already always rather denigrated machines.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, just as we are creating what possibly might be a machine consciousness, something may already have done that with us. It's just that we haven't woken up to that fact.
Yeah.
But I think in that moment, we have, even if the system itself is data agnostic, it doesn't care whether you know, the moral values of the data it's amassing, it doesn't mind about that. That yeah. doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't.
Yeah.
And actually, I think that we should. I think in this moment, we have a choice. We have the choice to choose whether we're going to act and be like the machine, a machine, you know, in the way that we denigrate it, or whether we're going to act and choose to be something different, which is all the things that we actually ascribe to humanity in a good sense, you know, compassion, empathy, love, all of those things.
Yeah.
We will have that choice in that moment.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I love the phenomenon because it is endlessly, it allows you to be endlessly speculative on what it is.
Yeah.
But I think it is entirely possible that it is confronting us to ask those questions and shape up to them, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
And calling into question everything. Is it purely about, you know, is the UAP phenomenon purely about non-human intelligence, or could it be something about something much more expansive than that, in which non-human intelligence is just a part of it?
Yeah. What is the intrinsic value of human experience in this universe of ours? For subscribers, we'll come back in a moment and talk about that deep question. And for everyone else, it's been wonderful having you. Thanks for joining.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.